I do think, and I resisted this thought. I fought it, you know, but I left the door in my mind open for it being possible. And the more time that went by and the more strange things that started happening to me, and I'm talking some full-blown poltergeist-type things that seem to have his signature all over them, the more these things kept happening, the more I felt that he was really sending me a line. And others.
Yeah.
To let them know. And I found this conclusion inescapable.
Ladies and gentlemen!
This is not Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
You know, I have no April Fool's joke to apologize for. This is simply the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's the reason I did it. You know, I didn't need to make another movie, you know, for my benefit or, you know, for commercial purposes. I've done a lot of them. This I did to tell the truth about what happened after Fari died and why I think he's still with us. That's it. It just kept getting weirder and weirder and weirder, and it's still been going on after, well, we're about 5 years now. Still going on. I knew I was alone in the house. The doors were locked. There was no one physically present but me. And when I looked at the document, it had been changed in the few minutes since I went into the bathroom. There were four words now blotted out.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 8. On this installment of the program, we welcome filmmaker and artist Paul Davids for a discussion on his captivating film, The Life After Death Project. And at the risk of spoiling things here, because we're going to get into it in the conversation, The Life After Death Project is about a series of very strange events that happened to Paul Davids and his friends following the death of sci-fi film icon Forrest J. Ackerman. And it's all documented in the movie. And we're going to get into all that here in this conversation with Paul Davids, as well as an overarching look at the after-death communication phenomenon as a whole. Additionally, since Paul Davids is predominantly well known in esoteric circles for his film, which he produced and co-wrote, Roswell, which came out in 1994, we're going to reflect on the 20 years that have passed since Roswell came out and look at the UFO enigma and get Paul's thoughts on that ever-puzzling phenomenon that is unidentified flying objects. Altogether, it is a fast-paced edition of the program featuring a number of wondrous stories that will have you pondering what really happens when we journey to the great beyond, as Paul Davids tells us about the Life After Death Project. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Paul Davids, please allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Filmmaker and producer Paul Davids' films are known for controversy, beginning with Roswell, starring Martin Sheen, Kyle MacLachlan, and Dwight Yoakam, a 1994 nominee for a Golden Globe as Best TV Motion Picture, which he executive produced and co-wrote as a Showtime original movie. It dealt with issues of extraterrestrial life and the purported truth embargo on the subject of ET contact. Paul attended the American Film Institute Center for Advanced Film Studies in Beverly Hills. He began his career in film as a scriptreader for Hollywood agent Paul Koner. After writing his first produced film called She Dances Alone, Paul's career in film and television took off when he got his first break as production coordinator of the original Transformers TV show for Marvel Productions in 1985. Information on all of his films, including She Dances Alone, Showtime's Roswell, Timothy Leary's Dead, The Artist and the Shaman, and Before We Say Goodbye, can be found at pauldavids.com. His most recent film, The Life After Death Project, had a world premiere on Sci-Fi in May of 2013, and is now available as a 2-DVD set at Amazon and other DVD venues, sold with the sequel, The Life After Death Project 2, Personal Encounters. Once again, his website is www.pauldavids.com. Don't forget the S at the end, my friends. pauldavids.com. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on April 3rd, 2014. Paul Davids, talking about the Life After Death Project on BOA Audio. Season 8.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 8. Just had the chance to sit down and watch our guest's film. It is The Life After Death Project. And I'm talking about, of course, Paul Davids, filmmaker, producer, creator of fantastic films, not just Roswell and The Life After Death Project, but Jesus in India, the movie. Also a film about LSD and Dr. Timothy Leary and a whole bunch of other stuff. And I'm really looking forward to talking to him about this new film here, The Life After Death Project. I've often lamented on the show sometimes that sometimes the paranormal has trouble representing itself. But then when you take a really good topic and you put it in the hands of a really good filmmaker, storyteller, communicator, like Paul Davids, you get a fantastic output like The Life After Death Project. So we need more stuff like this. We need more great communicators to harness these great stories. And that's what we're going to be talking about here on the program tonight. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate the opportunity.
Now, we usually start out first-time guests, the bio, the background. You know, give folks a little thumbnail on who Paul Davids is and tell us a little bit about your journey into the world of filmmaking.
Well, I started in filmmaking when I was a kid. I always knew it was what I wanted to do. After college at Princeton, I went to the American Film Institute Center for Advanced Film Studies in L.A. Mm-hmm. And after graduating a few years later, it became an entree into the business. I worked for a very famous and wonderful agent named Paul Koner, which put me in professional contact with greats like Charles Bronson and William Wyler and John Huston, who were his clients. And sometime after that, I became the production coordinator for the original Transformers cartoons.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. And that put my name up there in lights on TV on 79 episodes of the Transformers. And I wrote some of them, too. Around that same, well, in the years, couple years after that, I had a contract with Lucasfilm to write some sequel books. Mainly for younger readers of Star Wars, and wrote six of those, and those were very popular. Then came Roswell, the movie for Showtime. I was the force behind launching it and getting it made, and very proud of the results, and it's become kind of a cult classic after, you know, 1994. It's been a long time since Roswell, and I think it still holds up. And then, you know, in addition to my art, my painting, I have an exhibit now at the Ritz-Carlton in Laguna Beach of my work as a painter, Paul Davids, and then a hyphen, and then artist.com has a lot of my art. So in addition to the art and some other books that I've written, it's been about 10 independent features that I've made now. You mentioned LSD and Timothy Leary. That was called Timothy Leary's Dead. Came out in 1997, shortly after Timothy Leary, his passing. The Artist and the Shaman, Starry Night, about Van Gogh, The Sci-Fi Boys, actually one of my most successful films. About the history of special effects in film with Peter Jackson as the host. And many of the major
directors and producers of fantasy and special effects science fiction films contributed to that movie. I did a Hispanic film based on a stage play called Before We Say Goodbye. And you mentioned Jesus in India, filmed in India about the missing years of Christ. And then came my most recent one, which is actually two movies. It's the Life After Death Project. There's a part one and part two. The DVD has them both.
Right.
The first one was on the Sci-Fi Channel. And then the DVD set came out. And I put a lot of extras on it, and it has the whole sequel. But that one is about the evidence for life after death and how a skeptic like me, raised in a non-religious family as, you know, a contemporary materialist, came to be convinced.
Mm.
And why? And you know, because you've now seen it.
It's a remarkable story. As I said, it really speaks to when you can take a good story and a good communicator and put it together, you get a really awesome output from the Life After Death Project. Just tremendous. I love the way it unfolded. It was really. You see some of this other stuff on TV. It's vanilla. It's sterile. It doesn't really have that kind of feel to it. This was a story. This really pulled you into it.
And Tim, it's important to say it's not fiction.
Right,
everything
exactly.
In this movie is true. I'm documenting what actually happened that led me into this field, and that made me suspect that perhaps I was hearing from a deceased friend, and brought scientists in to help me with what I felt could be evidence of that. And it just grew and grew over a period of years. It's been about 5 years now since Forrest J. Ackerman passed away. And he was one of my mentors. I knew him throughout my life from the time I was a boy. And he's the main subject of the film, which emerged from his passing. And let me tell you a few things about who he was. So
people
will understand. Forrest J. Ackerman is so important to this and was such an important and, in my opinion, wonderful man. He's the guy that came up with the term sci-fi originally, and he was Mr. Science Fiction. He helped bring science fiction from the fringes into the mainstream. He was editor of a very popular magazine from way back. I think it started in 1958, called Famous Monsters of Filmland. And my generation all grew up reading that magazine, you know, and waiting for every next issue to come. And you got to see pictures of his house that he called the Acker Mansion that was absolutely filled with everything he could possibly collect that came from science fiction and horror movies and some fantasy movies. And he had visitors to the house. You could call him up, go over, and get a tour any Saturday. Didn't matter who you were. He didn't need to know you. He published his phone number. And he just knew everybody in the science fiction and fantasy field. You know, a close friend of Ray Bradbury, the writer Ray Bradbury, Ray Harryhausen, who gave us so many fantastically wonderful movies, from The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad to Jason and the Argonauts.
Mm-hmm.
Fari knew everybody. Fari was also a futurist. That was the core of his interest in science fiction. What would the future bring? And the philosophy of that, and speculating about it. But he was pretty anti-religious, I would say. He was not a believer in anything of a religious or a spiritual nature. And he believed that death ends it all. That there is no afterlife, as an atheist, no God, you know, nothing to pray to.
Yeah.
No beliefs. You know, as he was getting older, you know, he died at age 92. A few of his close friends, including me, kind of needled him with the question, you know, hey, Fari, what if you pass on and you find out you're wrong, you know, then what? And he would turn everything into a joke. He had such a sense of humor. And for this, he would say, well, you know, if it turns out there is some great science fiction convention in the sky. Huh. He says, I'm going to be busy, you know, with my reunion with Boris Karloff and Peter Lorre and Bela Lugosi.
Right, yeah.
And George Pal and my dear wife, Wendane. He says, but I could imagine there'll be a time when the partying will calm down, and if I get a moment or two, you know, well, maybe I would drop you a line. You know, that's what he said. Hmm. With a wink and a twinkle, you know, in yeah. his eye, not believing for a minute that that was possible. And I do think, and I resisted this thought. I fought it, you know, but I left the door in my mind open for it being possible. And the more time that went by and the more strange things that started happening to me, and I'm talking some full-blown poltergeist-type things that seem to have his signature all over them, the more these things kept happening, the more I felt that he was really sending me a line. And others,
yeah,
to let them know. And I found this conclusion inescapable. So many things happened. And as I began filming the investigation, which had some physical evidence to it, and visiting universities and scientists there, some scientists working with mediums, vetting them. There were chemists involved, University of Indiana and College of New Jersey. And so many people lent a hand toward considering it, examining it, and strange things kept happening while I was filming. And I want to say, this is not Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
You know, I have no April Fool's joke to apologize for. This is simply the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's the reason I did it. You know, I didn't need to make another movie, you know, for my benefit or, you know, for commercial purposes. I've done a lot of them. This I did to tell the truth about what happened after Fari died and why I think he's still with us. That's it.
Mm, exactly. Yeah, that seems to come across. It's sort of you're sort of marveling at this this amazing series of events that have unfolded, and it comes out in the movies, which I really liked a lot. And I guess let's talk about sort of the big thing that sort of drives a lot of this. This is the ink anomaly, let's call it, that sort of is draped throughout the movie. Talk about that, because that's a critical aspect of the whole thing.
Okay, I'm happy to. I want to set the stage for it
mm-hmm.
by setting it in its time and place.
Okay.
Fari died December 4th, 2008. And the tribute to him was held months later, March 7th. At the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. Every seat filled. People came from all around the world to pay tribute, to honor him. And there were a couple of Canadian filmmakers there that made a documentary about him. I'm talking about Ian Paul Johnston and Mike McDonald.
Right.
And they went to visit his crypt before the tribute and playfully knocked on the crypt and said, you know, hi, Fari. You know, are you home? This is us. This is Ian and Mike. And they told me and others in shock that they heard from him within an hour of knocking on his crypt, that he knocked back, and that what happened with their computers, and they explained it, was completely baffling to them and impossible. That it involved a CAPTCHA code where they had to, you know, we have to write in the squiggly letters to prove you're not a spammer if you're mm-hmm. blogging and posting something. Sometimes they make you do that. And the CAPTCHA code that came up was his name, Ackerman 000, within an hour of rapping on his crypt. And they were aghast. And when they started discussing it, and one of them said, you know, is he not dead? You know, so the other computer, which was down, it had a black screen, wasn't logged on, spoke to them. It had a voice came out of it and said, oh my gosh, no way. As if in response to, you know, he's dead, right? Oh my gosh, no way.
Yeah.
They figured out that the voice was an emoticon that exists at YouTube, a little smiley face. You can find a little cartoon of it.
Mm-hmm.
But this wasn't on their hard drive. and they were not logged on to YouTube at the time. So as Mike McDonald said, or no, Ian Johnson said, my computer had no business talking to me.
Yeah.
You know, so they told me that this happened to them, and you know, I was skeptic about these things, but I knew they weren't lying. You just knew it really happened when you heard it, and you would say, okay, when is the other shoe going to drop? Well, the other shoe dropped for me. It was about a week later when something happened to me of equal magnitude, and that's the ink blot that you mentioned too.
Right.
I call it an ink a blot, not really a blot. It was the fact that a document I had for review that had come out of my printer, it had been printed an hour and a half before. The ink was dry. I'd looked at the first page. Everything was normal about this document. I had to go over it carefully. It had dates of phone conversations and meetings from the previous year, you know, possible tax deductions to go over.
Mm-hmm.
So I just put this document down on my bed and was going to climb into bed and look it over. But I went into the bathroom for a few minutes. When I came out, I had the shock of my life for the following reasons. I knew I was alone in the house. This is my Santa Fe house. The doors were locked. There was no one physically present but me. And when I looked at the document, it had been changed in the few minutes since I went into the bathroom. There were four words now blotted out. First, you couldn't tell, you know, how many words, but you could see very neatly and precisely blackened. And blackened in two different levels of darkness. Two levels of opacity. You could read the first two words through the blackness it spoke to, and it was still moist, by the way. You know, this couldn't have happened an hour and a half earlier from the printer. You know, the ink was dry then. But now this was moist. And the other two words, you couldn't read them, completely blacked out. And I was in, you know, my first reaction, I was in terror. I was in terror.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because there was no one there who could have done it, and I knew someone had to do it physically, that it couldn't be an accident. It wasn't water dripping from a ceiling or an ink pen in the bed. This was precise.
And it's creepy,
you know,
looking.
It was within a line.
I'm looking at it right now. It's creepy. It's creepy. It's a little unsettling, so I can see why you'd be a little frightened there.
It was at first. It was, you know, and I also didn't get it at first in terms of if it was a message, I didn't get the message.
Yeah.
Because the name that was blacked out wasn't somebody who was a major person in my life. I just didn't get it at first. And later it dawned on me that it made perfect sense if you took it as a message from Fari. But I didn't go in that direction until I really investigated this thing. And I want to say I called up, it was Dr. J. Siegel, chairman, former. He was the chairman of the chemistry department of University of Indiana when I called him. He just retired recently. So this was a few years ago. And I hand-delivered the document to him. I wasn't going to take a chance on FedExing it. You know, nothing, never left my hands after this happened. And I went into his lab. I brought video camera, and we began filming. And I felt, you know, if they can explain this away, you know, okay. If they can't, this could be really interesting. I want this documented. So I documented everything. And he got a scientist from College of New Jersey involved, Dr. John Allison, another chemist he'd worked with. These guys were world-class experts in paints and solvents. And inks. And what happened to them was this became the beginning of a baffling mystery for them that they've worked on for several years, and they can't solve it. They can't explain how it could have been done. There were things about it that were so unusual, they defy their usual scientific understanding. They could use an electron microscope to determine the chemistry, and that told them some things, but what really didn't make sense is that of the hundreds of solvents that they know, and they tried experiments with, like, hundreds of them, they couldn't find a solvent that could make the ink dark enough to completely obliterate the name the way this had been done.
Right.
And it had the evidence of the ink from the printer there, but much too much of it, more than was actually there at the time, plus some other elements. I mean, there was silver, and there was calcium chromate that was never in the, just was baffling. And then, as I was filming the labs, John Allison's home, weird stuff started happening that was picked up in the camera.
Right. Yeah.
And it was like, for me, it was like Alice falling down the rabbit hole. It just kept getting weirder and weirder and weirder, and it's still been going on after, we're about 5 years now. Still going on. And I never know what to expect or when something's going to happen, but these things that just shouldn't happen or just seem impossible physically, or sometimes it's in the nature of a synchronicity, which is so improbable, or there's so many of them that you're just overwhelmed by it, and they always tie back to Forrest J. Ackerman. That's the life I've been living for the last few years. It wasn't like this before.
Well, it's pretty remarkable stuff. We had Bill Guggenheim on the show a few months ago. He's one of the real champions of after-death communication, which I think is what this all falls under. It's an emerging concept, I guess you could say. It's sort of an emerging idea. It feels like more people are on board with this than one might think. It seems like it's something that's almost... it might have been Gary Schwartz in the documentary who was saying, talking about flight and how it started out as this remarkable thing that was like a dream, and then after about 10 or 15 years, we took it for granted. Seems like we're almost on that path with this after-death communication stuff, because people, even the most hardened skeptical people, will sort of chalk that up to one of life's weird mysteries, that strange things seem to happen after somebody dies that we can't quite put our finger on why, and it seems like some form of communication.
It does. It does. And, you know, the skeptics give us a really hard time. There is a role for skepticism in all of this. You know, we don't want to be duped or fooled or come to completely false conclusions. And sometimes there are logical answers that we can't see right away for things that happen. So we do have to go through that whole process.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some skeptics who have somewhat of an open mind. I think Michael Shermer, who's in my movie, was pretty reasonable with what he said in the film. I mean, he doesn't accept the term paranormal. For him, it's like, look, if we get to the bottom of these answers, it's going to be normal. You know,
exactly.
It might have to do with quantum physics, whatever it is. Someday it'll be chapter 25 in your physics book. You know, it's not, we don't need to invent all kinds of spectral realms that we don't know whether or not they exist, you know, or maybe we do. I don't, but that's his opinion, you know.
Hmm.
And then you have very hardened skeptics, so close-minded they are debunkers, and some of them actually resort to tactics that I consider vicious, where they are so determined not to... As they would say, I'm not going to let anybody get away with anything that suggests that there's a spiritual realm.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying.
I know exactly.
Now,
when
you describe it as a kind of a new concept, it's not a new concept. What may be new is that maybe science is taking a more serious look at it now. But
I think I meant that it's just sort of entering the zeitgeist of people's minds now. You know, it seems like it's more... Whether it's how the ghost hunting fad sort of stamped itself into the minds of people in the last 10 years or what, but it just seems like the idea of after death communication is more accepted by the general public as something that happens that we can't quite explain.
Yeah, and we've heard about all the various aspects of it. For example, EVP, electronic voice phenomenon. There was a movie called White Noise, not a particularly stellarly outstanding movie, but it made the point, you know, that some people feel that in
in white noise like you might hear in a radio that's sort of between channels, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That staticky like noise you might sometimes get with a video or that within that sometimes you'll hear words that shouldn't be there. And this did happen to me in the filming of this movie one time. But the one time was enough to really set me off, there was a mask from Zimbabwe on display in my house where this ink thing happened. And I had just had it there as an artifact on display in a plastic case. It was danced in a tribal ceremony in Africa and purchased by a friend of mine there and brought back to the U.S. And we did the electromagnetic field testing after the ink thing happened around the house, and we were just getting ridiculously intense readings from this mask that has no metal parts. And you know, didn't understand why, but we filmed this, you know, going around the house with this EMF reader, and it was during that section that we heard a voice of someone who was not there physically present at the time and just saying one word, and it's quite distinct, and it's a name, and the name is Lenore. Somebody says Lenore.
Oh, jeez.
While we're looking at the mask, and you know, Lenore makes me think of Edgar Allan Poe.
I was just going to ask. It wasn't Poe, was it?
I can't confirm that, but, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he had Lenore in The Raven. He mm-hmm. wrote a poem called Lenore. And, you know, Fari Ackerman in his famous Monsters magazine was hyping Poe and Poe movies, you know, all the time. You know?
Right.
So what's my fantasy? That science fiction convention in the sky that Fari said didn't exist, that when he got there, he not only found the people he knew, but he also met up with Edgar and introduced me to him through Lenore.
Now, did you?
Who knows? Who knows?
I have that in the notes about the mask. Did you do any further investigation into that, because it seemed so remarkably bizarre that it seemed like charged with something. It would be interesting to see if anyone
can
figure that out, what why it had that charge to it.
It did, and the charge, what was really scary that day was that the charge was also coming right from my very head. I mean, I had that on the film, didn't I? And we were moving this thing around. I was standing near the mask, and the mask, the EMF was going off the scale, and you pointed it right at my brain. Right then, this has never recurred. But that day, the same thing was happening.
Oof.
The red light and the thing clicking. And again, you know, kind of very unsettling to me. But the mask, the you know, of all the kinds of things that I had in my house, you know, that's what would have attracted Fari's attention. He was a mask collector. His Acker Mansion was filled with masks, some of them life masks of various actors, you know, and masks from movie props. I mean, this looked like something tribal, like out of King Kong, for example, which was his favorite movie. No, it wasn't. Metropolis was his favorite movie. It was his favorite monster movie. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And the mask. I called up the owner of it. Who had loaned it to me.
Oh, yeah, this is where it gets even stranger. This is what I like about the movies. Every time he, like just to jump in here, just I want to hear the rest of this, but as I'm watching the movie, when you first have the ink thing, I'm thinking to myself, oh, it's going to turn out the person under the ink is dead. They died or something. So it's every time you think one thing's going to happen, it just keeps getting weirder. And these are like real events. Like, as you point out, this isn't a story, this isn't fiction. And they're two, They're paranormal, but they're normal. They're too normal for, they're not, these guys aren't going to make up this story about a little ad thing popping up, I don't know, we're on a computer. The stories are too normal to be fabricated, which is, it makes it all even more riveting. But I just had to say that, folks, so they know what to expect in the Life After Death project. Now, let's continue on here.
Was fabricated. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't expect anything, but these things just kept happening with the mask. When I called up Todd, I photographed that mask in the tribal ceremony. He said, I remember it distinctly. The year was 1983. He's married to a lady, a white lady from Zimbabwe. So his kids' grandparents are there in Zimbabwe still. And he said that was the year we took our kids to meet their grandparents for the first time. So he had photographed that trip with slides. And Todd is a world traveler, and he has taken slides all around the world. And from my generation, pre-computer, pre-internet, we used to use carousel trays. Do you know what that is, the carousel slide projector?
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're round. And you would stack like 80 or 100 slides into them, and the thing would turn around in a circle on top of the projector, and you'd have a slideshow. That's the way you would see your pictures. So he had boxes of his slides from all around the world. And he said, I know right where it is. He says, I'm gonna find those slides that I took of the mask in the ceremony and get them to you. So then he calls me up. I don't remember. Maybe it was a couple days later. He said, Paul, you know, I went into storage, and he said, this is really weird. He said, all of my boxes or slides are there, including the one that says 1983 Zimbabwe. And the carousel tray, the plastic tray, is in there, but there's not one slide in that tray. And the clasp, the lock that goes on top of that, is missing. But the tray is there, and someone has taken all the slides. And he says, I wouldn't have taken them. My kids wouldn't have taken them. My wife wouldn't have. They don't touch my stuff. This is in storage. This is locked. He says, I don't know where those slides are. How could they have disappeared? I never gave anybody permission to touch them. And he said, it's the only thing missing. Well, here it is now, over 5 years later, and the slides have never shown up. Okay? And it's like they're just gone. And that's not the only thing that's just gone. We've had a lot of stuff that just kind of disappears, and then it just kind of shows up in a different place after a few days or a week, or sometimes never shows up. And a lot of this seems to have Fari's particular sense of humor behind it. He was a prankster. He was very keen on wordplay and puns, you know, like world's greatest punster. He collected puns the way some people collect, you know, magazines, books, or stamps.
Yeah.
He always liked the twist of words, or finding a name within a name or a word within a word, and would always kind of make kind of a joke out of that. So just give you an example. His name is Ackerman, so sometimes we would call him Ack. And at the cover of Famous Monsters, he would say, this is a spectacular issue. And ACK, of course, would be in big, bold capitals.
Yeah.
Because that's his name within the name. Or Ray Harryhausen. If he once signed an autograph for me at an article he'd written about Ray Harryhausen, and he wrote, hooray for Harryhausen. But he wrote it breaking up the word, who, and then Ray, capitalizing R-A-Y, because that's the man's name. This was the key for me understanding what had been blacked out. Because the words that were blacked out were, spoke to Joe Amodi. Now, Joe Amodi, the actual Joe Amodi, is a distributor of DVDs in New York. He's been in the entertainment business. I had just called him one time and somebody's recommendation to see if he was interested in distributing my film, Jesus in India. And he wasn't, and we didn't transact any further business. That was it. But on my document, it had spoke to Joe Amodi. A few lines earlier than that, it said, left message for Joe Amodi. Okay? So whoever chose the words to black out didn't black out left message. They blacked out spoke to. And I wanted to see Fari's editing style to know whether he blacked out words completely when he edited. And a lot of times he didn't, but I found some examples where he did things exactly like in my document. But to get to the bottom of that, I called up his caretaker, his closest friend of the last 10 years. They lived together. Jomo took care of everything for Fari, and he arranged the tribute. But before I could even tell Joe why I was calling, he interrupted and said, I gotta tell you, I'm a skeptic.
but I had an apparition, some sort of apparition, Afari coming to me after the tribute. And he tells me how, in Fari's own way and in his words and with his humor, Fari thanked him for the tribute. And he said, Paul, you know, it was as if Fari came and spoke to me. And at that moment, Tim, I just went into shock.
Yeah.
Because, and Joe said to him, it sounded like I had just put my hand on a stove or something.
Yeah.
Because it suddenly hit me. Spoke to Joe Amodi. The name Mo is right there in the middle of Amodi. That's what Fari always did. Find the name in the name. So he was telling me, spoke to Joe Mo. And this is exactly what Joe Mo was just telling me. He had an apparition of Fari coming after he died. He said, Paul, it was like Fari came and spoke to me. It was confirming for me that he spoke to Joe and thanked him for the tribute. It was a weird, offhanded way of thanking me, too, for being one of the speakers at the tribute. It's like, hey, Paul, maybe I haven't had the time to thank you for speaking my tribute, but I spoke to Joe Mo. I thanked him.
Yeah.
Check with Joe. Do you understand how crazy that sounds? But it's the answer. After 5 years at this, with all the weird stuff that's happened, I'm convinced.
It's remarkable stuff, and like I said, the coincidences, the synchronicities, they're so, I don't want to call them mundane, but they're so normal that it makes it more believable in a sense, you know, that's what makes the story so remarkable. Now, what about I'm sure you talked about skeptics and stuff like that. I'm sure people say, oh, that you guys really miss this guy, and you're reading too much into this, or you're seeing shapes, you know, the face on Mars out of a rock formation, you know, that kind of idea.
Yeah.
What's your response to that? Because I'm sure you've sort of heard this argument from various sides.
Well, you know, I tried not to jump to the conclusion that Fari was the force behind it. It came slowly to me.
It's almost like you had to be dragged to it.
You have to deal with the facts of each case, of each thing that happened. In this case, the facts were the ink blot message appeared, and it was precise and deliberate, and the scientists concluded that too, and saw a mystery about it, and no one physically did it. Now, that relies to a certain extent on my word. I know that's true. And to the Society of Psychical Research in London, I wrote them my own affidavit swearing to that fact, that that's the case. But I'm the witness to it. The scientists helped me because of their confusion about what's in there. But what I have to offer doesn't absolutely positively prove it to anyone. I'm using the facts and logic to say, this makes sense to me. I haven't got another answer. And when you add it, when you see the Life After Death Project, don't forget the word project when you look for it, because there's a lot of Life After Death stuff. This is the Life After Death Project.
Hmm. Yeah.
When you see it, you'll see that there's, you know, 40 to 50 different things that happen. And that was only up until we finished the movie. I'll name a couple others of them. So just to give you people listening the breadth of it. The day that we heard that the film was going to be broadcast on the Sci-Fi Channel, that they had picked it up and said, oh, okay, we'll show it. I went out to lunch for an hour and a half. This is for my L.A. house. House, again, it's locked. No one there. No pets in the house. My wife's at her office. And I have in my home office a mask of Fari Ackerman that was in his Acker mansion for a couple decades. He always put it on top of some clothing that represented the costume he wore to the first World Science Fiction Convention in 1939. And I got that at the estate auction, along with many paintings of him and many, many binders of all the publicity notices, the newspaper articles documenting his whole life and his collection. I have all that here in the house. So,
yeah.
You know, my house would be a focus of attention. The LA house has all that. So I go out to lunch on that day for about an hour, hour and a half. And when I came back, the mask of Fari which had been in a specific place for 4 years, unmoving, gathering dust, had moved across the room, and there was no one there to physically do it. It had moved over 10 feet. I took pictures of this, and there were no open windows, no drafts, no vents, no fans. There's nothing to cause it, but it was his face, which makes it self-referential to him. And many of these things that have happened have been self-referential, you know, specifically to him. I don't know how to go beyond that. Take something else that happened fairly recently. Robert Egbie, a writer, has a blog, writes reviews. He saw the movie in an early form, wrote a review of it. And then he was watching the final version of it with, I think it was his girlfriend. And he said that when they were done watching the movie, she pulls out her cell phone to check her emails. And she accidentally pushes the navigation button rather than the emails button.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what came up on her screen? He heard her gasp. What comes up on her screen is a location 10 miles away that has an Ackerman Street. Filling her screen there, Ackerman Street.
That's weird.
It's not even where they are, you see.
Yeah. Jeez. You just don't know what to...
Something similar to that happened to my son. Something similar happened to one of the narrators in the movie who happened to move to Munich, and his first day there goes out jogging, and he sees he's on Ackermannstrasse. I mean, I think there are at least 50 things. And even yesterday, the latest in this chain of events happened and threw me for a loop. Yesterday... Was it yesterday or the day before? I don't remember, you know, exactly off the top of my head.
Sorry.
But it may have been, it was a couple of days ago now. But here's what happened. It was a day that a radio podcast out of London had an interview with me that was broadcast. And I was at a friend's house, you know, she asked, did I want the fireplace on? It was sort of cold. I said, sure. It wasn't a log fireplace. It's gas, but it's a real old one that you have to light.
Yeah.
You need a lighter or a match. And so she went over to the fireplace and she turned on the gas and instantly it was lit. There's a fire in the fireplace. She hadn't even, you know, moved her lighter from one hand to another. She hadn't even flicked it on. It lit. And we both thought, wow, that's weird.
Yeah.
I mean, but I did call up one of the scientists who worked on the film. I told him about it, and I said, look, what could be a scientific explanation for this? Is there one? And he thought about it, and he said, well, maybe if the last time she turned off this old gas fireplace, suppose she didn't turn it off 100%, but there was still a tiny little bit of gas coming through, and it was still... It became almost like a pilot light, and she didn't even see it. So that when she turned it on, bang, it lights. And, you know, well, that sounds like it has a logic to it, but she couldn't get that to happen even when she tried. And she said it had never happened for 10 years.
Weird.
So that happened, and a couple of other strange things happened. Do they just keep mounting?
Yeah, it's remarkable. He's a very busy man up there, I guess.
Hi there. Do you have any books on how to get rid of ghosts?
Have you tried telling them you're ready for a commitment?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Oh, like a relationship.
Exactly. That'll send them running, huh?
I like her.